In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about higher education and very specifically what are looking at some of the barriers that exist for people who come from disadvantaged circumstances, particularly low-income families. What are some of the barriers that prevent those people from going to college? And what might be done to create greater access to those individuals and make it more possible for them to go to college? Now, certainly it is true that particularly over about the last 50 years or so, access, inclusivity in higher education certainly has been on the increase. And yet there are still significant numbers of people who, for a variety of reasons, aren't able to go to college. We'll try and talk about the subject this morning in this part of Focus 580 as we talk with two guests. Our guests are Martin Kurzweil and Eugene Tobin. Both of them are associated with the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Martin Kurzweil is a research associate at the foundation. He's been working there for the past couple of years, and he has, during that time, collaborated on several research and writing projects, including one, Reclaiming the Game, College Sports and Educational Values, that was published by the Princeton University Press in 2003. Eugene Tobin is program officer for the Liberal Arts Colleges Program at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. He served as president of Hamilton College from 1993 until 2003, where he also served as professor of history and dean of the faculty from 88 to 93. The two of them are two of the three authors of a book that explores this subject. And certainly, if you want to get into it in greater depth, you can look for the book. It's titled Equity and Excellence in American Higher Education, and it's published by the University of Virginia Press. The third author on the book, by the way, is William Bowen. He is former president of Princeton and is now president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. As we talk with our two guests here this morning, of course, as always, questions and comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That number, 800-222-9455. So, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Kurzweil, hello?
Yes, hello.
And Mr. Tobin?
Good morning, David.
Thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
The book explores a lot of territory, more than perhaps we can do in just the conversation, the time that we have this morning, because it does try to look a bit at the history of higher education in the United States. But just to start with that just for a moment, perhaps we could talk a little bit about how well we are doing in an historic sort of sense and talk about where we are and where we have come from when it comes to access to higher education, that is the ability of Americans from various kind of backgrounds to be able to go to college.
Probably, David, the best place to begin is as late as World War II. Because up until World War II, the percentage of young Americans of college age who went on to college or university was extraordinarily small, between 2 and 5%. After World War II, as the economy changed and the world became increasingly aware of the importance of education, increasingly larger numbers of Americans began to seek access. Most Americans will remember the GI Bill of Rights as sort of a turning point, a transformational point, and the expectations that veterans had upon their return from the war. In the 1960s, as America's public universities began to expand, including the creation of community colleges, that really opened the doors to a larger segment of the population than it ever before participated. Mm-hmm. But it's really not until the post-1960s that issues of selectivity, accessibility, and affordability have become of increasing importance to this country.
Yeah, so we could say that for a long, long time, the number of people who went to university was small. And actually, as you point out, I think we need to remember that it was probably only sometime in the last century that most people actually even went to high school or completed high school. So maybe we wouldn't be surprised that not that many people went on to university.
Right. This was true even for those who could afford to go. There was really no economic incentive. There was no credential that was deemed so important that one aspired to attain it. And until that happened, the colleges and universities were largely the redoubt of those who primarily were looking for an intellectual experience or access, for example, to the clergy, one of the few professions that really depended upon institutions like small colleges to produce the next generation.
Mm-hmm. And also, again, an important point that we have now, it's perhaps been relatively recently, but we have indeed been more successful in creating opportunities in a higher education for minorities and for women.
Certainly. And that's a very, very recent vintage, probably the last 40 years in terms of both gender and race.
Well, let me ask you a slightly different question. I think that it ought to be obvious the value of higher education to the individual and the value to society of having a number of people who have advanced education. Let me ask this question, and it's in a sense kind of an insider question because probably only the thing that people at a university would ask. But the question is, having made the point that it's of value to society and to individuals, what is the value to the institution, to the university, to expand opportunities for all kinds of people to attend college and university?
Well, I think the primary goal of these institutions is to educate their students, and one of the main benefits of having a diverse group of students is that the students there are exposed to a wider range of viewpoints and receives a better education simply by dint of being exposed to people from different backgrounds, people from different cultures, and people from different socioeconomic classes.
And I think, too, that and this is perhaps, again, a point that maybe only people in university communities think about, but it is a fact that for some time now, the quality of education in the United States, higher education, particularly when it comes to people who are interested in advanced degrees, has drawn students, graduate students, from around the world. But it has become increasingly difficult for foreign students to come to the United States to study. And I think that there are some people who are concerned that if it becomes more difficult for foreign students to come, that universities are going to have a difficult time attracting significant numbers of students, no matter where the students are coming from, that might indeed make it more important for us to recruit and to admit and to retain more American students in colleges and universities.
Undeniably, David, I think one of the things that we've seen since 9/11, of course, and the passage of legislation like the Patriot Act, is it has become much more difficult for foreign graduate students to enter this country. And although the government has gone a considerable ways toward trying to redress those procedural issues, the larger question is that even without 9/11, the United States' position in the world economy in terms of educational attainment has really fallen significantly. Right now, according to 2002 data, the United States ranks eighth, for example, below a number of other prominent nations in terms of the percentage of those who attain a college degree. And this is happening, of course, in our country in spite of the fact that the markets clearly want more and better, more highly educated college students, yet there's a significant percentage of our population who are not responding to the economic demands and incentives that are there. And we try to identify that as one of the main themes of the book, that it's not just access and equity that are of importance, of critical importance, but just as important as the nation's position in the world economy in terms of educating a segment of our country who are really not getting the benefits that would enable the United States to compete globally.
Mm-hmm. So expanding the pool of people who are at least applying, if not being admitted, is good in one sense for universities because it's good for diversity, which we think is good, but also that we're expanding our talent pool, and that the more difficult it is to get into college, then in a sense you're saying that we're crippling the university because we're denying potential talent, and we're also crippling ourselves and the economy because for the same reason.
Yes, the two are inseparable. You really can't look at the equation of those students who are not receiving the opportunities or benefiting from the privilege without appreciating the fact that the downside is that the country's competitive position is eroding.
Hmm. Let me very quickly again introduce the guests for this part of Focus 580. The last person you heard speak is Eugene Tobin. He's program officer for the Liberal Arts Colleges program at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. And also with us is Martin Kurzweil. He's a research associate at the Mellon Foundation. The two of them are two of the three authors of a book-length study that's titled Equity and Excellence in American Higher Education. It's published by the University of Virginia Press, and as I said at the beginning, looks at some of the barriers that exist for disadvantaged students who might want to be able to go to college here in the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let me just ask flat out, what are the major obstacles? If you ask, why is it that we have significant numbers of both minority students and disadvantaged students, people who come from poor socioeconomic backgrounds that are not going to college, there might be some things that would seem kind of obvious, like the cost, but there might be a number of other things too. What are the most significant roadblocks?
Well, the cost is certainly a factor, David, and there's no denying that. Though one interesting finding is that there's a lot of research to suggest that it's actually the pre-collegiate preparation, both academic preparation and sort of study skills, social skills, aspirational type preparation, that are far more important for a poor student's chances of going to college. Another factor that comes into it is related factor is sort of the very practical skills involved in applying to college and applying for financial aid. The students from poor backgrounds, from families that don't have much experience with higher education, have trouble with that as well.
Yeah. You just touched on there, one of the things that I think is a factor that's worth talking about and worth acknowledging, and I'm sure that it has a number of dimensions, and that is the difficulties that people face if they're the first person in their family to even think about going to university.
I think the most significant takeaway that we came across in the course of researching the book is the extraordinary information deficit that exists among families below certain income levels, just in terms of the most basic awareness of what the process is like, everything from applying to a different range of institutions, understanding which institutions might have financial aid, understanding the difference between a grant, a scholarship, as opposed to a loan. And although colleges and universities work extraordinarily hard and spend millions of dollars trying to reach prospective students, the truth is that for a great segment of our population, many students who come from low-income backgrounds have very, very little real negotiable information that would help them understand the difference between going to a local branch of the state university, for example, as opposed to a more elite private institution. And we argue in the book, and I think correctly, that colleges and universities need to expand the pool, but they have to do so by working very closely with school districts, that the kind of academic preparation gap that Martin referred to really begins almost in the point of birth in terms of the cognitive skill development, the kinds of conversations that take place around the dinner table, access to reading newspapers, to understanding the ways in which the world are changing, and certainly the kind of advising that is made available to youngsters in middle school and high school. Mm. All those are crucial factors in shaping a student's aspirational level.
Well, I have a couple of callers here, and I want to get right to them, but just very quickly to pick up on that last point you made, it seems to me that certainly colleges and universities, there are a host of issues that they have to confront that have to do with the process of admissions, and then there is another set of issues that has to do with retention, with once you get students in, doing what you can to make sure that they're successful and that they do graduate. But it seems that an awful lot of the things that you're talking about here they're not things that colleges and universities can deal with directly. They have to do with the experiences of students long before they ever even think about applying to college.
That's very
absolutely
true.
Absolutely. Which isn't to say that there's nothing for colleges and universities to do. As Gene mentioned, partnerships between colleges and local high schools, elementary schools can be very valuable.
Well, let's talk with some of the people who are listening here. We have two ready to go. The first is here in Urbana, line number one.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I was so pleased to hear your guest say that this began at birth, because as an old-time elementary and later adult educator, it does. You know, if kids come to school 5 years behind, their college aspirations are a big struggle. So I was really glad to hear them say that. I think those of us who have lived in the community remember a program called the 500 program, where kids from disadvantaged cities throughout the United States were brought to the university. And I think with very mixed results, some okay, but a lot not okay, that just bringing them here and giving them the opportunity when they're 18 or 19 isn't fair to them. For kids who have had 18 or 19 years of college preparation in their homes. So I'm a big advocate of Even Start, which is an adult education program combined with an early childhood program that takes children 6 weeks of age with one of their parents, and they educate them both. And I would just kind of like to hear what your guests had to say about those points. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thank you. The two of you can take them on however you like.
Well, we would certainly support the last caller's point emphatically. Certainly, early childhood programs play a key role in helping to shape and influence children's and their families' later decisions. But what we're describing in the book, of course, is really it's societal. And as you pointed out earlier, David, the kinds of things that colleges can do, though they have an immediate impact, are only going to be of long-term value if we attack the roots of the problem, which we've identified sort of as a supply-side block that is directly related to healthcare, to the quality of schools, to the chances and to the opportunities that neighborhoods that are unsafe don't provide students who grow up in situations of precarious existence. So everything that we try to identify in the book as being central to breaking the supply-side block really focuses in upon what needs to be done almost from the point of conception in helping children move through the pipeline, as we describe it, from primary school up through to college graduation.
Also, we should point out that our research suggests that the low-income and first-generation students who attend selective colleges do remarkably well there. They earn the same grades as a student who, with the same SAT scores, who is in the top income quartile. They graduate at approximately the same rates as other similar students. They are very successful students, and that extends beyond college as well, in terms of earnings, in terms of careers, in terms of civic participation. There's very little difference between the poor students that we studied and their wealthier peers. Now, that's not the case with every set of students who come from what we might call disadvantaged backgrounds. In fact, underrepresented racial minorities, African-American students, Hispanic students, American Indian students, underperform when they're in college. They earn grades that are somewhat lower than we would expect them to earn based on their other characteristics. But the underperformance is not huge. It's certainly a problem, and it's certainly something that needs to be addressed, but it's not huge. And those students, once they graduate, also do exceptionally well, just as well as their non-minority peers.
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the call. Let's talk with someone else. We have someone here on a cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah. I'm just going to echo what the previous caller said. It's been a bit since I've done this, but I had taught introductory classes of a couple different natures at the university, and it was very evident that there were a fair number of people who were there were people across the spectrum who were showing up not very well prepared, and in general, I think that what we often do in this country is try to fix at the collegiate level what really should have gotten fixed at the primary or secondary level. But it was very disheartening to see, some of the minority students, many of whom were very hard workers, but they just were clearly not ready. They weren't really prepared well enough. And I'm kind of wondering to what extent places like community colleges could really benefit this particular population. You know, in a sense, a lot of higher education institutions would really like to have lots of students, a very diverse student population. But I really was wondering whether these students that I was teaching were actually getting served by being here, where they were not. They just weren't really ready for it. I mean, I'm not saying these people were dumb. They weren't. They just really weren't ready for it. I don't know if you care to comment, and I might follow up.
I think that's a terrific observation in many respects, in the sense that community colleges actually are playing an extraordinarily important role in educating students from a variety of income levels, but particularly those for whom going to college would be the first experience in their families. What we are tracking at the foundation as part of possibly a next research project and perhaps in collaboration with other institutions is, can community colleges serve as a transfer point for students of high academic ability but low income in terms of gaining admission to highly selective institutions? Because we have found, as Martin indicated, that the low socioeconomic students who attend highly selective institutions do exceedingly well for all the reasons that Martin alluded to. But we think that there's a larger population who are not being admitted, and that might be a series of questions that we can delve into a little bit later in our conversation. But many of those students are currently at community colleges, but selective institutions have not developed as fully as they might the kinds of arrangements that are often referred to as articulation agreements with community colleges that would enable there to be a real pipeline for successful community college graduates who really have earned the right to attend a highly selective institution.
It's also certainly the case that the selective institutions have focused much more on admission, have focused much more on getting students from minority groups, from low socioeconomic status backgrounds into the schools, and have focused much less on helping them once they're there. And that's certainly not something that we advocate. The schools take on responsibility when they admit students, and that responsibility is to ensure that those students learn, that they have a good educational experience, regardless of the level at which they come in. And I agree with Jean, and I think you make a good point that community colleges can certainly provide it sort of a bridge, but I think that the selective schools can also probably do more to help those students adjust.
Well, certainly I know, at least I can only talk about the program. I mean, I can only talk about how they ran it here, but I remember having to file, you know, there was a program that tracked people, but I think one of the issues, and it strikes me, I mean, if you look at, you guys probably know more, I'm sure you know more about this than I do, a lot of times things like associate's degrees or actually have a really huge payback for, they have a huge return on investment. And I wonder to what extent, in many cases, a lot of people really wouldn't be better, you know, really well served by, you know, more pursuing that route. I mean, and not necessarily, and then extending to a four-year degree. I'm thinking some of my friends who I went to high school with got associate's degrees, worked for a while and went back and finished a bachelor's or something. You know, so there's people who do this kind of stuff. I mean, my dad did that. My brother did that. So I have a PhD, so I'm in a different category than that. But anyway, I just really think that in a lot of cases, people need to be very clear about what they want. And that's where I would agree that a lot of these people just, they don't know, and their family really doesn't have the information to tell them. But it seems to, I'm sure, you know, the community colleges are getting used, but I really think that community colleges and institutions that draw from community colleges really benefit a lot of these people just immensely, because they're really set up to deal with that population, whereas a place like the University of Illinois, it might well have to stretch itself into a pretzel to do it. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to hang up.
All right. Well, any further comment that you want to make on what the caller had to say?
Just one, having spent some time with community college leaders fairly recently, and that is to really commend the community college system, quote-unquote, across the country for the exceptional work that it does do. Some of the data that I've seen recently suggests that 45% of all first-year college students in America are attending community colleges. So we shouldn't underestimate the real role that these institutions are playing, both in terms of preparing students for for the next 2 years beyond the associate's degree, but also for giving this generation of students a chance to get their toe in the water in terms of experiencing college in a manageable setting. I think the point that Martin and I are making, however, is that we think there are students from both racially and economically disadvantaged backgrounds who are not receiving the opportunities that they might at selective institutions, in part because there's no one sitting around the admissions table for them who's advocating in their behalf as strongly as are other advocates for other kinds of preference groups, such as, let's say, recruited athletes, for example, or the children of alumni. And part of the book, of course, that we think deserves to be given some serious thought, focuses in upon what can institutions do in terms of allocating scarce spaces, especially at highly selective institutions, in terms of addressing what the Boston University economist Glenn Lurie has referred to as education being a serious sacred and public trust.
I'd like to introduce our guests once again. Our guests here this morning, Martin Kurzweil and Eugene Tobin. Eugene Tobin is program officer for the Liberal Arts Colleges Program at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and served as president of Hamilton College from 1993 until 2003. He also taught history there and was dean of the faculty. Martin Kurzweil is a research associate at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. He's been there for the past couple of years. And at the foundation there, he's collaborated on a number of research and writing projects. Just one I do want to mention, as it might interest some folks, has to do with college sports. It's titled Reclaiming the Game, College Sports and Educational Values, published by the Princeton University Press, 2003. They are two of the three authors of a book that looks at the subject that we're talking about here this morning. So if you'd like to explore it in greater depth, you can seek out this book. It's titled Equity and Excellence in American Higher Education, and it is published by the University of Virginia Press. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I would like just to make the point that the study that you did and the one that's discussed in this book takes a look at the experiences of the sort of students we're talking about at a number of selective colleges and universities around the country, including a number of Ivy League schools like Harvard and Yale, some selective liberal arts schools, among them Barnard and Smith and Swarthmore, and a number of state schools, including Penn State and the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. The kinds of issues that we've talked about, those barriers for students, disadvantaged students, to go to elite schools, do they also apply to to all higher education? Let me put it that way, because I don't really want to sort of set up some kind of hierarchy that says one place is better than another. Is it really the same no matter where it is the student is thinking about trying to go?
And David, if the issue is selectivity, I think the generic response would be yes. It's a fairly similar type of competition and experience, whether you're applying to Urbana-Champaign or whether you're applying to, you know, one of the elite private institutions in the country.
So gap in college attendance between the wealthy and the poor really extends across higher education. Students from the top income quartile, young people from the top income quartile, are about twice as likely as those from the bottom income quartile to attend an institution of higher education, any institution of higher education.
Okay. Let's talk with someone next listening in Spring Bay. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I teach at a community college, and just to comment on what you guys were talking about a few minutes ago, our Department of Institutional Research has tracked our graduates who transfer into four-year schools, and what we've discovered is that our transfer students generally do better than the four-year students in terms of GPA and that sort of thing. I think that's kind of an interesting comment. And I just wanted to share that with you and see if you guys had anything to say about that. But if you are interested in doing any kind of research on community colleges, you might contact the community colleges to see if they do have, like we do, a Department of Institutional Research might be able to help you out with that. I'll hang up and listen to the rest of your show. Thank you.
All right. Well, do you want to comment on that?
Well, we certainly want to thank your caller for that appropriate plug and commend him for the good work that he's doing at the local community college. One of the points we try to make repeatedly in the book is we do think that students such as those who are attending community college, particularly those who are first-generation college goers and from low socioeconomic backgrounds, because they have triumphed over so many hurdles, really do deserve very, very careful consideration, and we think even what we refer to as a thumb on the scale at the time of admission at selective institutions because of all the hurdles they've had to jump over just to get into what in the book we refer to as the credible applicant pool, which is no mean feat, especially at a selective institution.
Well, though, you'd said a little bit earlier you thought perhaps colleges and universities had not done a very good job of recruiting from community colleges or making kind of contacts with community colleges and drawing on those institutions as a pool for students who would then come over and pursue more advanced degrees.
Right. I mean, that's a sweeping generalization, of course, but I think it's not unfair to say that community colleges are probably an untapped pool for many highly selective institutions.
Next caller is in Herrick, Illinois. This is line number 1. Hello.
Howdy. Mm-hmm. Couple of comments. First off, on the need for the degree that's become so prevalent in society today, I used to do a lot of work within the government, and what I found is there's a large prejudice within college-educated people to hire college-educated people. In a lot of government jobs, there'll be two ways of qualifying for it. You can either have a particular degree or you can have particular experience. And quite often when I was applying for a job, I would meet somebody personally and they would be ready to hire me. And then when they found out I didn't have a degree, they would be ready to rewrite the standard to accompany me or to qualify me. And it's like, no, it doesn't have to be rewritten. I qualify based on the basis of my experience. And so there seems to be a huge prejudice among college-educated people to only think that's the only way to learn skills. And then my second interest was when I was going to college to gain some skills, the entry into college is really made difficult if once you're out of the high school system. And the very fundamental questions that a man with a family has to answer is how much is it going to cost me? Where am I going to get the money? Those two questions are almost hidden away, and I put a lot of effort into finding out the answers to those. And in my local community college, I just got lucky. If it hadn't been that one particular person was sick so that they had to hand me over to another chief financial officer in there. I'm not exactly sure what her title was, but she was several levels above where the normal entry person would deal with her normally, and she had the answers right on the tip of her tongue. It took her maybe 5 minutes, where everybody else I was dealing with was basically telling me those are unanswerable questions, and those are the basic ones the guy's got to know. It's like, you know, what's it going to cost? How am I going to feed my family? How does this stuff work? And I think, kind of like what you were saying, the schools put the, you know, they have these programs in place, but there's just a little bit of a disconnect between the person on the ground level trying to get in and what the administrators of the college are saying. And I'll go ahead and hang up now and listen to your discussion on air.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Either both of you want to respond to some of the things the caller said?
Sure. Well, just to take the second comment first, I think it's a great point that there is often a disconnect between the kind of financial aid programs that are available and the awareness of the applicants of those programs. Gene and I were discussing that a little bit before in the context of applications in general, but it's certainly true at both the institutional level and in terms of government financial aid. The institutions will often publish a sticker price. They'll publish a tuition rate that is nowhere near what they actually intend to charge the students. It's usually much higher than what they intend to charge the students because there are all sorts of financial aid programs, et cetera. But if you went to a school's website and most schools' website and looked, you would find that higher sticker price. Government financial aid, federal financial aid, the form that every prospective student has to fill out, the FAFSA, the Free Application Federal Student Aid, is certainly less complex than an itemized tax return, but it's much, much more complex than the quick file form. And a lot of students from low-income backgrounds and their parents only have experience with those less complicated forms. And so immediately when you enter the financial aid process, you're confronted with this, you know, what seems like a really massive amount of paperwork.
Well, it sounds like that. Well, certainly one of the things that we know is that over the past few years, particularly the cost of college education, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a public college or a private one, has gone up. And I don't think we're going to see that turn around. Then if you ask the question, well, what are we going to do to try to make it more possible for people to deal with the cost? And it sounds as if it's going to have to be we're not going to cut tuition. We're going to have to provide different kinds of financial aid. Or maybe the answer is that we need to get better at hooking up people with the financial aid that is available. And I don't know if that is a high school counseling issue or if that is a college admissions issue or maybe that is some of both.
It's probably also, on a certain level, an effort that requires a public and private combination of dedication. Mm-hmm. The institutions, you know, college and universities, certainly need to be much more active and aggressive in promoting the fact that their sticker price is not necessarily the price, as Martin indicated, that a student with financial need will end up paying. But they don't do that, I think, as well as they can. I know a lot of institutions are trying to focus on ways to get their message out in an effort to enhance the population of students who will think much more seriously about attending a highly selective public or private institution. But I also think that we can do much more at the college level to work in partnership with secondary school counselors to reach those counselors whose information pool may be limited, for example, to the colleges and universities within the general geographic extent of the schools in which they teach, but who have less information about what's available nationally. Because many of the institutions about whom our book is written draw on a national pool, and yet it's not always cost-effective for them to send admissions counselors to different parts of the country, especially to rural areas, to visit small regional high schools where they've never been before, because they really can't judge or assess the quality of the students. There need to be ways to create bridges or liaisons between those kinds of school districts and nationally selective institutions to convince the institutions that these are very bright, highly qualified applicants who deserve to be given the most serious consideration. So I think it's a series of things that requires a lot of coordinated attention.
All right, let's talk with another caller here. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I've been listening with half an ear here, and I find it a little disturbing the way you're couching this whole problem. We, all the different segments of society, pay their fair share towards supporting, in particular, these state schools, and I see no reason at all why they shouldn't be reflect the composition of the state population. And all these excuses you're making up sound a lot like as if a hospital had the luxury of complaining that it's those people that come into its emergency room that are obese, you know, well, it's okay if they fall off to the wayside and have a higher mortality rate because, well, you know, they weren't prepared. You know, I think it's your whole take is very, very class-oriented. But there were a couple of things, so I'm kind of negative about your whole spiel here. I have a couple things I'd like to hear you talk about, though, and one would be the foreign students. There's a huge percentage of foreign students on this university, for example, and I'm thinking, you know, it's nice that we allow foreign students in and give them a little, quote, enlightenment, unquote, and they go back to their countries and, you know, and it helps for world peace and our world economy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But first, you know, you should be serving the population in the state. And I wanted to know if, you know, because in many cases, only the best jobs are only attainable through college degrees. So I'm wondering, is a large part of the reason that we have so many foreign students in our universities the fact that they are paying a higher rate of tuition? And I've got one other thing I wanted to ask you about.
Well, can you, I don't know who wants to, maybe Mr. Tobin, you want to take that one on?
Well, I heard several questions in the last caller's comments. Let me address the second part of it. The numbers of foreign students who are attending America's universities, including the University of Illinois, add an enormous amount of intellectual firepower to the experience of all the students with whom they come in contact. And in many fields, especially in science and engineering, there are more foreign graduate students than there are American graduate students, especially true in engineering. And without those foreign students, America's engineering colleges and universities would be at a great disadvantage. Moreover, whether the foreign students stay in the United States after they complete their degree or return to their home countries is really not the issue. If they stay, they're improving and certainly attributing to the productivity of our own country, and if they return, they're doing the same thing there. The earlier question, commented by your caller, something that I did want to address, and that had to deal with the state school issue. What are we trying to suggest in our study is that if you're talking about selectivity, then there's a real dilemma for flagship university campuses like that at Urbana-Champaign and at Madison and at Ann Arbor. And one of the suggestions we make, we sort of toss it out there as something that we think is worth consideration, is if the flagship university campuses are to remain as competitive as they need to be for all of higher education, because you need to have a strong public and private sector, we think there's something to be said for freeing them up to charge tuitions of their in- and out-of-state students that are competitive with the tuitions that that private universities are charged, our students are charged. But we would also hope that the states, in those instances, would take the subsidies that might have gone to the flagship universities and use a great deal of that money to address the needs of students who are attending the what we refer to as the regional public universities, students who are really on the cusp of stopping out on occasion, students who can't always guarantee on graduating within 4 or 5 years because the courses are not offered as often as they would need to be. So we think there's a real balance and a dilemma that states face in terms of trying to maintain the selectivity and the competitiveness of their flagship campuses and at the same time serve their public role, their civic role of educating the citizens of the state.
Well, you didn't answer my question as to whether or not the foreign students are paying a high rate of tuition and that, whether that was a significant reason for their being so highly welcome. Your argument about the that our engineering schools, et cetera, would be heavily hit if it weren't for the foreign students coming in. Well, that's well and good, but you have to realize that by taking up all our educational resources and putting it toward this particular segment, you're neglecting others, which have traditionally been neglected, the minorities, the disadvantaged, the economically disadvantaged, and so there is a high cost to what you're talking about, which you may not feel personally, but a lot of people do. And I wanted to know, I wanted to ask one last thing, and that is that the idea of people not being prepared. I was wondering, how do you explain and believe me, I think Texas is usually a negative example in almost every case. But apparently their experience with their 10% rule, where they take the top 10% of all high schools in low economic situations, high economic situations, you know, high achievement, low achievement, they just take the top 10% of all high schools and allow them to attend their schools, their universities. And how do you explain the fact that they can do that and that the graduation rates are fine across the board? They don't, you know, they don't see a big distinction between the top 10% of a barrio school versus the top 10% of some expensive school, highly supported school. And how do you explain that? And why isn't it that we shouldn't be able to duplicate that in, say, Illinois? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, to answer the earlier question about foreign students' tuition, there aren't actually very many foreign undergraduate students. Most of the foreign students are in graduate programs in the U.S. And they would pay tuition for those programs, then the tuition is the same as other students. Most of those graduate programs have some kind of a stipend or scholarship. Foreign students are not, as far as I know, are not eligible for federal student aid, but that doesn't affect how much money the schools get. As for the question about the 10% program in Texas, I'm not sure that the results in that are as clear-cut as the caller described. I know that there were some initial positive results. The students admitted through the 10% program were doing very well, but I'm not sure that that continued. And I think the reason is that there was greater take-up of the 10% program. So you had more students coming in from less prepared backgrounds. Another problem with it is that it ends up the more students who take advantage of the program, the fewer spots you're going to have at the university for other students. And a university like the University of Texas or Texas A&M, while many of their students are from Texas, and presumably they want to have many people who are high achievers in their high school. They also want to draw students from other states. They really consider themselves, to an extent, national universities, much like the University of Illinois. And when you are dealing with a national university, the 10% plan just isn't practical. You can't say that you're going to accept the top 10% of every high school in the country, because you'd have way too many students applying. What we prefer is a more targeted effort at attracting students from disadvantaged backgrounds, in the style of affirmative action that goes on at many of the selective schools that we discussed, where students are considered on a more individualized basis. There's no one statistic, there's no one test score, there's no one grade point average that will get a student in. It's the student's whole portfolio that gets them in or doesn't get them in. And we think that kind of a program leads to much more well-rounded student bodies. It leads to students who are probably more likely to succeed in college and afterwards overall. And it is, in general, just better at achieving both institutional and societal goals.
We're going to have to stop there. I'm sorry, we've simply used the time. For people who are interested in exploring further the subject, you look for the book. It's titled Equity and Excellence in American Higher Education, published by the University of Virginia Press. Our two guests, two of the three authors, Martin Kurzweil, he's a research associate at the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, Eugene Tobin, program officer for the Liberal Arts Colleges program at the Mellon Foundation. Mr. Kurzweil, Mr. Tobin, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.